Femi Oke. It has been 2 weeks since Russia invaded Ukraine, and getting humanitarian aid into Ukraine is beginning to be increasingly difficult. So that is our focus today. And we start with Al Jazeera correspondent Charles Strafford.
Underground metro stations is where many people hide. Young and old stand patiently in line for food served by volunteers. A bowl of soup, salad, and bread. Ilona and her 12-year-old daughter, Nastya, show us the train carriage where they've sheltered since their home was destroyed.
It started 12 days ago. Our house was destroyed. We don't know where to live anymore. I don't know where to go with my child. Honestly, help us. There are many here like us who have lost everything.
What a question to have to ask the world. And who do you ask for help? Humanitarian work on the front lines of the Ukraine conflict right now. That is what we're talking about. We're going to be doing that with Olya and Jens and Step. So welcome to all three of you. Thanks for making time. I know you're all super busy. Olya, please introduce yourself to our stream audience. Tell them why you're relevant to today's conversation.
Hi, I'm Olya Yarechkievskaya, co-founder and board member of Razum. We are dealing with the emergency crisis response right now in Ukraine. We were established in 2014, and we've been working on Ukraine and various projects from IT to fashion. But right now, all of our efforts are devoted to humanitarian assistance and also evacuation of children with special needs.
Oh, yes. We're looking forward to hearing more from you in just a moment. Jens, good to have you here on the stream. Please introduce yourself to our global audience.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jens. I'm a spokesperson for the United Nations Humanitarian Coordination Office in Geneva. So what we do is helping all the international organizations, whether it's UN or non-governmental organizations who want to help in Ukraine, get coordinated so that they can provide the best help to those people so desperately needed, as we just saw on your clip there.
Sure, absolutely. Hello, Step. Good to have you on board. Please introduce yourself to our global audience.
Hi, I'm Step Fasen. I'm currently in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, covering the story for Al Jazeera English. And I've also covered the story on the other side of the border in Poland for the last couple of weeks.
If you have questions for Step or Jens or Olya, now is a really good time to ask them. You're watching things on the news and it's not making sense for you. You want to help. You want to talk about humanitarian aid and humanitarian workers. Comment section right here. Be part of today's program. All right, Olya, that story of the mum who is living in a carriage underground, that is one story. And to really understand the impact, we kind of have to do it person by person. It's not a mass of people. It's every individual person and a family. What would you tell us to also help us understand the kind of work that you're doing and why it's needed within Ukraine?
I absolutely agree with you. Right now, millions of people are affected in Ukraine. But we cannot just think about numbers. We need to think that it's each individual person. And each of these lives is invaluable, and there is a story behind each of that person. We have been dealing with evacuating families of children who have this rare genetic disease, spinal muscular atrophy. We have worked with them before, and we know this community really well. We have been successful in evacuating a lot of them, but unfortunately, some of them are currently stuck in Mariupol, the city in eastern Ukraine that is heavily shelled right now. The last message I have from these families is 9 days ago. It's SOS. We have no food. We have no electricity. We have no medicine. And you just feel completely trapped and you don't know what you can do and how can you help these people. And I just pray and hope that there will be a safe humanitarian corridor established soon that the poor people of Mariupol can live. And I hope that these two families that we have there are safe.
Jens, Oya says you don't know what we can do and how we can help these people. That is your job. That is you and Ocha's job, focusing on what's happening and what the needs are in Ukraine. When you look at the country, how are you planning to help people? Where are you and what are you doing?
Yeah, first of all, you're absolutely right. It's not the numbers, but still the numbers do give a sense of how bad it is. Mm. It is a crisis where we estimate that some 12 million people are in need of assistance inside Ukraine. That's not 12 million. That's 12 million individual disasters. It's a crisis that went from relatively bad conflict, but slow burning in the east a couple of days ago, into now having reached apocalyptic proportions. We are doing what we can to get our assistance ramped up. We did have before the 24th of February, of course, a UN infrastructure, if you like, a humanitarian program inside Ukraine that is now being beefed up very, very fast. We have had, like so many others, had to leave areas in active fighting. That did not mean that we left Ukraine, not at all. Mm-hmm. We want to stay. We have now got our staff in places where they can actually regroup, think about what can we do to get the assistance going, because it's critical and it's getting worse by the minute as we are hearing.
Step, if you're looking at the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Ukraine, how would you share that with our audience? How have you been sharing that with our audience?
Well, I think the very, very first need that people have here is safety. You can't really help people if there's a war going on and also ceasefires are being violated. So what we've seen is that evacuations from towns that are under fire, that are being shelled by Russian forces right now, that they have also been hampered by continuous shooting. So humanitarian aid is going in, but it's also being shot at. People who bring in aid, they risk their lives at the moment. So what they really need is safety. And everyone who I have been speaking to in the last days and weeks, actually, is saying to me, please close the skies. That is a really strong demand, strong wish from people here in Ukraine. They say, close the skies. They say, we can fight these tanks, but we can't stop bombs falling from the sky. And I was in a place not far from Kiev, in the Zhytomyr, and three residential areas were completely destroyed by Russian shelling, by rockets, by missiles that came down, including a school. A lot of schools have been destroyed. Hospitals, as we know, have been destroyed. Mm. And there's nothing people can do. They wake up in the morning by a huge sound and their village, their neighborhood is destroyed.
I want to go to some reporting from Jonah Hall from Al Jazeera, because you mentioned a hospital being under attack, and Jonah also saw that happen too. And then I'm going to go to YouTube, because we've got some questions, particularly for Jens and for Olya. But first, here's Jonah Hall.
A day of relative calm along temporary avenues of escape. War came suddenly to the people of Ukraine. Getting away from it is much harder. From cities like Sumy in the north, where residential buildings were struck, and from Energoda in the east. Even from Mariupol in the south, among the most embattled of all, they're fleeing scenes like this, the remains of a maternity hospital, another inexplicable tragedy in conditions the Red Cross describes as apocalyptic. For many civilians still trapped in the ruins of their cities, there is no respite, nor for medical teams in hospitals where the injured arrive daily.
On YouTube, we've got questions about how do you protect the humanitarian workers when you are coming under threat from fighting? It's like, how are you able to do that? Jens, do you want to start? And then, Olya, you can pick up.
Yeah, thank you very much, because it's a very critical question right now, because everybody wants to help all these hundreds of thousands of civilians who are in very dire need. It's our job. It's our obligation to do so. So we need to get a system in place whereby we can ensure two things. First of all, that those who are in those encircled cities who are under fire have a safe passage out in a direction of their own choosing. We are talking to both sides of the conflict. We have a team in Moscow now talking to officials there to get a system in place where this can happen. The second thing that we need is then for aid to move into where the most critical needs are. There will be people in a city, even if there is a safe passage out, who for whatever reason will stay. They will need humanitarian assistance of all kinds, and we need safe passage in. We need the agreement from the men with guns that they do not shoot on us. And to make that happen, they need to understand what it is we do, when we do it, why we do it.
So, Jens, let me just ask you, this is all common sense, but you have to make this happen. Who are you talking to right now? Because those humanitarian corridors, we keep hearing on the news, well, there was supposed to be one, but then people waiting in a line to collect bread were killed, or people crossing a bridge were killed. So you and OCHA, people wondering, who is doing this? You have to do it. You have to talk to Ukrainians, you have to talk to Russians. Can you explain a little bit more about how you do that?
Yeah, and we do so. Those corridors were agreed between the Russian Federation and the Ukrainians. The United Nations is not operationally part of it. And that is why we go in and say, we actually have, us and also our Red Cross colleagues, quite some experience in how to set this up so we don't jeopardize people's lives. So
that
is safe to do so.
Tell us, how do you do it?
So we speak to military commanders on the ground. We speak to military commanders and foreign ministry officials in the capitals, Kiev and Moscow, to get the agreements, to get the things such as standard operating procedures in place for them to implement.
Step, you look like you're about to say something.
Clearly,
go ahead.
Yeah, they're clearly not listening, because what we've seen is evacuation buses being shot at, humanitarian workers, especially here in Ukraine. What I've seen so far is mostly local organizations, local volunteers. I mean, everyone in Ukraine who hasn't fled the country is basically now a volunteer. They're all helping. They're collecting food. They're collecting clothes from friends, from relatives, and they're risking their lives going into the most frontline cities, where the battles are really raging on. And many of them, of course, risk their lives and also are shot at. So far, we haven't seen that any agreement has been held so far. People are really stuck, and of course, they're terrorized right now.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
And for this reason, I would also would like to go back to the point Stephanie brought up, that Ukrainians are asking to close the sky. And there's a big humanitarian need in that as well. There's a need to protect the civilians, to ensure that these corridors are not violated, to ensure that these bombs are not falling on these children's and maternity hospitals, and that innocent civilians are not killed. People are crying out for this. And there are, I'm sure, many creative solutions to this. And Ukrainians are asking for the global community to come together and to solve this. And the no-fly zone is essential to preserve lives of innocent children and people.
Oh, yeah. When you hear Seb, you go first. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I just wanted to add, that they really feel abandoned at the moment by the world. You know, they feel like the world is watching while their cities, their schools, their hospitals are being bombed. And they appreciate all the attention now in the West on this war. But they feel like there's a lot of words but no action. So really desperate pleas for help I hear all the time.
Oh, yeah. When
I think that Ukrainians have a lot to show to the world and inspire the world in a way of action. As Stephanie described, people are organizing on the ground. We have people on the ground, our very close friends, our volunteers who have been working with us for years. They are going all over the country. And my grandmother, who's 80 years old, has a full house of refugees in Western Ukraine. Even she's doing her part. And I think that this is a call to international community. We do appreciate the support incredibly. The emotional support is huge, but emotional support doesn't give tangible support, doesn't protect Ukrainian people from the bombs, doesn't protect them from starving, doesn't protect them from being sick in these conditions where they cannot have proper care.
Let me just bring in a new voice to our conversation. This is Lauren Carruth. And Lauren Carruth is looking at Ukraine humanitarians, but looking at it from a local level. Let's have a listen. Let's have a look.
I think we need to provide equitable services, support, and protection to local aid workers, Ukrainians for the most part, who are doing relief work on the ground. Local aid workers typically receive a fraction of the pay, benefits, training, and security services that expat international aid workers receive. They get fewer security details, less armor, less life insurance, less health care, and less mental health care services, but they perhaps need them even more.
Oh yeah, how are your volunteers doing on the ground? We've got Jens in the big part of the screen, because Jens, your team have support, they have backup, they have, you know, you can switch them in, you can switch them out, they're going to get time off eventually when they get out, compassionate leave, etc., etc. Oh yeah, but what about your volunteers on the ground? What do they
get? My volunteers are working 24/7. They sleep where every, you know, the driver volunteers that we have, they go to the cities, they pick up children with disabilities, their families, they transport them, they sleep together at different locations where they can get, a place to sleep. It's a very tough work, and these guys are essentially also mobilized. So when they are called to the army or territorial defense, they will be gone. And essentially, as you said, there is no rest for them. And I would like to say that I think this invasion of Ukraine has psychological effects far-reaching, even outside of Ukraine. We are based in the U.S. All of our team is extremely mobilized. I'm a scientist, and for 2 weeks now, I just cannot do my work, because all I can think of is getting children out to safety. And so many of my coworkers are doing the same. They either left their job, took vacations, they are neglecting their families, and this is affecting the world now.
On YouTube, Brian says, international humanitarian law is supposed to protect civilians. Why are there airstrikes targeting residential areas? And what is being done to ensure accountability? I feel like I'm going to split this question between Step and Jens. Jens, you explained the process by which you create a humanitarian corridor. You talk to generals on both sides. No one is listening. This is illegal. Jens, go ahead.
Well, absolutely. This is not something new. This is an obligation for all countries in the world. And I just want to address a couple of things, because the frustration is very high. I understand that. The United Nations have stated the vast majority of our staff are Ukrainians. The internationals we have, they have stayed in Ukraine. They have all been moved to safer locations. So I feel we are in the same boat here. On the message about stop shooting on aid workers when they try to go in and help, I could not agree more. But we need to send that message in the right direction. And we are amplifying that message all we can. But we are also ourselves, as United Nations humanitarians, we are under the same conditions as everyone else. And I think it's important to understand that there is a United Nations that works, if you like, on the conflict, how to stop the conflict. And then there's the United Nations that work in the conflict, for as long as it goes on, because we cannot leave people behind. So we are doing what we can to make this safe passage of people out, safe passage of supplies in, happen. It should have happened days ago. I fully agree, but we keep working at it, and hopefully in coming days we will see some progress on this.
Step.
Well, why are rockets falling down on residential areas? That is exactly the question that many of these residents, civilians, have. They have asked me why. We are not a military target. Vladimir Putin is saying we're only hitting military targets. Obviously not. This is a school. This is a neighborhood. And we were called brothers. The Russians called us brothers. And now our brothers are doing this to us. So there is this complete despair and an unreal feeling that in 2 weeks' time, there's a huge destruction, villages destroyed, cities destroyed, and people are still trying to comprehend why, and how is this possible? So there's all these questions, and of course the government here is calling it a war crime and a genocide, and a lot of people are agreeing with that. So this despair, I think, is something that is really, really present in the whole of the country right now.
Earlier, we spoke to Leila Matar. She is from the Norwegian Refugee Council, and this is what she told us.
There needs to be an immediate ceasefire to enable life-saving relief for people in Ukraine. One of the biggest challenges with delivering aid to the millions of Ukrainians who find themselves at the front lines of this senseless war is that aid workers themselves are having to flee from attacks. My colleagues with the Norwegian Refugee Council in the Ukraine tell us that they're having to hide for hours and nights in cold and dark bomb shelters, and they can't save lives when they're under a constant barrage of bombs and grenades. And that's a huge problem because the needs in Ukraine are rising by the day.
I want to show our audience and also Olya a graphic, a map. It's on my laptop right now. Let me explain what it is. It's been compiled by two news agencies, the AFP and Reuters, and they looked at all of the countries that are either providing military or humanitarian aid to Ukraine. So that is what we're seeing at the moment. That's as of this week. So you can see the outpouring of how do we help Ukraine? And this is always a question that we're asked every time we do an episode like this. People are watching and they're thinking, now what do we do? Olya, what direction do you want to give our audience?
I really call on the international community to unite and keep providing military assistance to Ukrainian government and unite to close Ukraine the sky, to arrange for a no-fly zone. This is really important to save the civilians and to give a chance to Ukrainian military to defend Ukraine. And I do believe Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian government, Ukrainian people are all extremely united right now, and everybody is doing everything they can to stop this Russian invasion into Ukraine.
Okay.
And I would ask everybody in the world, reach out to your governments, ask them to support Ukraine in tangible ways. And we really hope that this will be done very soon.
Jens, I shockingly have less than 1 minute left, so I'm going to ask you in a sentence from UN OCHA's perspective, what would be your ask to the international community watching right now?
I think our ask is purely humanitarian. I want to say two things. First of all, we have seen the neighboring countries to Ukraine receiving over 2 million refugees. That is very welcome. I ask those people to also open their hearts to the Ukrainians.
Thank you so much. Jens and Step, I know you will continue to see Step's reporting on Al Jazeera. And also, Olya, thank you so much. I'm going to send you back here to my laptop so that you can continue to follow our three guests whenever you need to on social. This is Razem for Ukraine, where you'll find Olya's work. Olya co-founded this organisation. This is Jens. He will keep you up to date for sure in what's happening in Ukraine. And of course, Step, that is her job. Thank you for your insightful questions and comments. We do appreciate you. I will see you next time. Take care.